Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Thursday, January 9th. From HPR2, it's The Conversation. New year, old topic. GMOs never went away, though opponents wish they would. We'll talk with UH crop specialist Hector Valenzuela. We'll also review the Hawaii Supreme Court's decision about an indigent parent's right to representation in child welfare cases.
Then we'll take a trip to Tibet in search of spiritual healing. And to cap the conversation this hour, we'll come back home for a peek at the Maui Pops.
So stay here. All the conversation starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris Vanderkirk.
This is one of the most interesting of the ongoing local debates, and it certainly is ongoing. That's give it that, yeah?
Well, that's true, and we're not going to stop talking about GMOs anytime soon.
No reason to.
Well, certainly not so with what we've seen even over the last week or so with that New York Times article.
Yeah.
And there will be many, many more as the eyes of many in the country and certainly worldwide are focusing straight on Hawaii. So let's get to it. Yeah, it may be a new year, and for a lot of people, it's a time for new beginnings. But for the group of folks who would like it to be an end of GMO food, they'd like it to be an ending as well. The movements in many communities around the state continue to press for the expulsion or greater regulation of GMOs. One of the longtime voices in the discussion over GMOs is UH Extension crop specialist Hector Valenzuela. He's speaking on a panel this evening, and he joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethan. Thank you for having me.
Nice to talk to you again. Now, you know, Hawaii has had a fight over GMOs. It seems like it's been going on now forever, and it's certainly gone far beyond our islands, and we mentioned a moment ago, just this week, there was that lengthy New York Times article. What's your read of all the attention that Hawaii is getting? Is it helping, or is it just sort of mucking it up even more?
It is great to have this level of discussion, and it is great to see that the discussion has broadened at the national level. However, we talked earlier about the narrative of the discussion, and it becomes troublesome when the narrative becomes defined by the line that the industry is trying to portray or by those that are promoting the technology.
Is the line of the narrative also being shaped by those who don't have enough information? I mean, you're a scientist, you're attached to UH and CTAR, and clearly GMOs have played a part in your department.
Correct. It is difficult for the general layperson to figure out what's going on because there's so much background noise about the issues, and of course there is a lot of extreme positions on both sides. But when it comes to the power of relay information in the public sphere, we know that the industry has a lot of resources. And as we have seen with this New York Times article, Amy Harmon's position is almost reflects line by line the industry position, and that becomes a little troublesome.
Specifically what? Articulate that.
Just a couple of examples. For example, the perspective that those that promote crop biotechnology are on the side of science, and those that are against it are against science or are not following science. And that is somewhat preposterous because there's respectful scientists on both sides of the issue that are raising these questions, and it is part of science to ask questions about the safety. It doesn't mean that you're against it. It's just you're asking about the science.
We also have seen in many cases where people have said, well, yeah, my science is better than your science, and the infighting with scientists. Or is that just a public perception?
It is part of the debate that people say, well, there's science on both sides. However, I go back to the industry narrative. When they are able to affect the narrative, and this comes with a conflict of interest when research is put forward, but it's research that has been funded by industry, so that research is confounded by a conflict of interest.
Journalists are often told when they're studying to be journalists, you need to consider the source. With a lot of these studies, that applies as well, doesn't it?
Correct. So we saw this with the tobacco industry. We know that when there was a lot of questions about secondhand smoking and so on, the tobacco industry funded a lot of scientists to do research on alternative, what other causes could be causing these health disorders, and their focus is to try to create uncertainty about the health risks of the product that they're selling.
When you talk about extreme positions, we've been hearing lately things like, well, GMOs are linked to autism, and yet looking for some of those studies seems to be a little sketchy. Do you draw the line at some of what's being said?
Yeah, you have to be skeptical on both sides. But the problem from the public's perspective is that they are in the dark because there haven't been independent studies to evaluate the safety of these products. The products are unlabeled, so it's difficult to conduct post-marketing studies. So the public is in the dark, and they are observing that several diseases have spiked up over the past 20 or 30 years, and they're saying, could these be caused by GMOs or by the pesticides that are used to grow these crops?
But that idea of pointing fingers and saying, you know, this is causality here, the GMOs, doesn't seem in some cases to have real studies behind it, as you've just said, and needing to have independent studies. And many people have called for those independent studies over time. Do you think we're ever going to see that happen in the very near future?
I think this level of discussion that is increasing in the public is probably going to bring about this type of studies. But I should just point out that with the link to autism, there is research. Dr. Senef has done a review linking the use of Roundup and its effect on microbial activity in the gut and also in the soil. And we know that microbial activity affects cytochromes and enzymes, and these may have an impact on nutrient access, which in turn may affect some diseases such as autism. So I'm not ready to make a conclusive remark, but it's something that we should be looking at.
She's coming in from MIT to be on the panel with you tonight, but as you say, you're not ready to make a conclusive remark that this is so or isn't so. How do we get more independent studies to be able to see conclusively whether these things really do cause what some people believe they do, or whether this is just looking to, load the basket with as many terrible things that GMOs could do as possible? How do we get something real?
Well, this comes back to the article by in the New York Times, and she's portraying councilperson Illigan as the sole person looking for the facts. But it's actually the other way around, because when independent scientists step up to ask questions or to want to do research about the safety of GMOs, they are marginalized, they are attacked based on a integrated industry program to disqualify them. So it's difficult for independent scientists to step up and conduct that research. And the industry controls the seed. They can control, say, well, you don't have access to my seed, so you cannot conduct this research. So we really have to open the doors to allow for young researchers or for research in general to conduct independent research.
What do you think it says about us as a society that we seem to castigate the search for question or the search for answers in asking the questions that you've just articulated?
Well, we have such a drive to develop solutions based on technology instead of what is best for society. And we have such a drive for profits that the university is becoming privatized. We're encouraged to gain patents and so on. So when researchers come up and stand up against this tide for profits, it becomes troublesome to administrators and to the system. But society has to step up and say it's important that we create products that are safe for the environment, that are safe for health, and we need independent research on both sides.
Well, let's hope we get some of that soon. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with your discussion tonight.
Thank you, Bethann.
Dr. Hector Valenzuela is an extension crop specialist at the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources. He's part of a panel discussion this evening, and the details are on hpr2.org. at 8:13. You're in on the conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Coming up, Mysteries at the Top of the World. Now, a sound synonymous with Hawaii in today's Backyard Quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawai.
In Hawaiian, kanilea means joyful sound. With a meaning like that, it makes sense that one local ukulele company decided to use the word as its brand name. Crafted by master luthier Joseph Souza, kanilea ukuleles are known for their sound as well as the high-grade, well-seasoned woods found in both their professional and economically priced instruments. If you're on the island of Oahu, you're not too far from where kanilea ukuleles are meticulously constructed. And for today's Backyard Quiz, we want to know if you can tell us the location of the company's headquarters. If you know the answer, post it on Facebook at HI Conversation. If you aren't sure, stay tuned for the answer a little later in the show.
Hi, good morning. I'm Sonny Shaws from upstate New York. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
While you're still contemplating the answer to the quiz, perhaps a virtual trip to Tibet might help relax your mind. Tibet is one of the world's most mysterious places, a society built at impossibly high elevations, home to an ancient and little understood spiritual legacy. Hawaii-based author Zia Okogiri, is descended from generations of African healers. He's felt a kinship with Tibetan traditions, and he traveled there in 2012, planning another trip there for later this year, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Zeal.
Good morning.
It really surprised me when you told me that when you traveled to Tibet, you just kind of showed up, because I always thought it was a place that was very difficult to get in and out of.
Yes. Yes, it is.
What do you think made it different for you?
You know, I don't know. Maybe I was just lucky. When I went to Tibet and I met the Tibetan officials upon arrival, actually I took a train from Beijing to Lhasa, which took 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine, getting there, I met the Tibetan officials. They were very, very kind to me. And he said that it would be okay for me to spend some time in Tibet. Normally you need a Chinese visa, which I had. You need a Tibetan permit. In addition to that, you need a guide.
Mm-hmm.
So he waived the permit and the guide and asked me to have a good time in Tibet.
Which you did and saw some things that I suspect few travelers get to see.
Yes. What I recognized was that spiritual devotion was very strong in the hearts of Tibetan people. There is so much love and compassion among them. And the way they interacted with each other and also the way they welcomed visitors to the Holy Land,
mm-hmm.
It was very moving for me. They couldn't speak English. Most of them don't speak English. And they speak Chinese as well as Tibetan language. And I didn't speak much Chinese either. But if I was looking for a place, they would leave what they were doing and actually take me there instead mm-hmm. of just giving me directions on how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so it was really a very moving experience for me that I felt that more people need to come to Tibet. And if they could feel and experience half of what I experienced, I think it'll be really a wonderful treat for them.
It's given that you are originally from Nigeria,
yes, yeah, yes,
and that you're in a country where you frequently go into a profession kind of through heredity, through the fact that your family has done it for a long time. Your family was healers, right?
Yes, I came from a long lineage of healers, what the Western people will call shamans.
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandfathers were all shamanic healers. They were great herbalists. My father was both a medical doctor and involved, very knowledgeable about African botanical medicine. So this is passed from one generation to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a part of that. And spirituality has been a part of our lineage.
And that's the link from Nigeria to Tibet.
Yes, right? That is the link. Mm-hmm. I have explored many spiritual traditions from the African shamanic traditions to Christianity, to Buddhism, to Hinduism, all the isms I can get my hands on. And, you know, this inspired me to go to Tibet to actually experience how Tibetan Buddhism is practiced.
What do you think was distinctive about it? What were the strongest impressions you got?
The strongest impression that I got from Tibetans is that they were not making any effort to practice. Like in the West, we go to church and make the effort mm-hmm. to be spiritual, mm-hmm. to do things that are spiritual. Tibetans are simply living the spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of their life. They're not doing anything. It's like you and I going grocery shopping. It's just a part of their life. You see them going to the monasteries. You see them circumambulating the monasteries to purify their mind to receive merit. You see them going to spin the prayer wheels.
Did you say circumambulate?
Yeah, circumambulate. Yeah.
Walk around.
Walk around, yes. Uh-huh. Walk around the monasteries.
Uh-huh.
And the reason they do
spinning
that.
Spinning the prayer wheel.
Spinning the prayer wheel, walking around the monastery. There's so many pilgrims.
Mm-hmm.
And these are not just foreigners coming for the pilgrimage. These are Tibetans coming from different parts of Tibet, coming to a place such as the Jokhan Monastery, which is at the Boka Square in Lhasa.
Mm-hmm.
It is the most important monastery in Tibet.
That would be the one of which people might have seen photographs, if they've seen any photographs of
yes.
Tibet.
Yeah. Yes, you have the Potala Palace, which many people see photographs about. But you cannot miss the Jokhan Temple.
Mm-hmm.
And you will see people in front of the temple, prostrating in front of the temple and circumambulating the temple, saying prayers. And I was told that prayers have been said in that temple every single day for 24 hours for the past 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you feel that when you're there. Yeah, you
really do, huh?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You feel the devotion, yes.
One of the things that you witnessed was a remarkable practice, ritual, whatever you call it, of a kind of something I wouldn't expect in a monastic context, which is a kind of a debate of theological doctrine, if you will. Is that a good description of it?
Yes, indeed. You know, I was fortunate enough to visit the Sierra Monastery. It's also in Lhasa. And this is where the monks are trained. And many, many years ago, before the Cultural Revolution, there used to be up to 10,000 monks being trained at the Sierra Monastery. But now the numbers have dwindled down considerably
mm-hmm.
To perhaps 1,000 or so. And as a part of the training of the lamas, they have to hold this mock debate among themselves while they had lama watches to see how they are doing in their training, in their understanding of the Buddhist doctrine. So they would all gather outside and they will study debate. They will be grouped perhaps, they have about maybe 20 groups all debating among themselves. And when a monk tries to make a point, he emphasizes the point by clapping his hand and gesturing to indicate how important, how vital that point, that particular point he's trying to make is.
You know, it's just, it's one of the many remarkable things you've seen, Zio.
Yes.
I thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Real
thank
pleasure.
You. Yes.
Dr. Zeal Okojiri is the author of Journey to Freedom, The Power of Resilience. He's leading a trip to Tibet in July of this year, and details are at hpr2.org.
Lost boys to responsible men in South Sudan.
Joseph Akolmakir came here in 2003 with four younger siblings, all orphans.
A woman from Fargo, North Dakota reflects on the current unrest in South Sudan and the people she's worked with and helped for nearly a decade. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, following the conversation.
Throughout the year, you turn to HPR2 for news, information, and ideas. We've been there for you, and we're counting on you to be there for us. Financial support from station members makes the programming on HPR possible. We gratefully acknowledge Sarah and David Stanford of Honolulu, Kalei Allen of Kihei, and Eliza Lathrop of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Now it's your turn. Make a tax-deductible contribution to Hawaii Public Radio today by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours, or you can click Donate Now at hpr2.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii, serving Hawaii since 1897. Whose 2,400 employees strive to achieve the values of Hawaii, family, community, and hard work every day. BOH.com. Member FDIC.
The University of Hawaii has an ambitious plan to reduce almost $500 million in its repair backlog, mostly at the Manoa campus. But while that happens, the construction could cause overcrowding as we've never seen before. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we mentioned that we're talking about a very expensive proposition here. We're also talking about one that is long term. What we didn't talk about is this is sort of forecast to go over the next 10 years.
That's right. And, you know, there's 20,000 students at Manoa alone, 4,500 employees. So imagine having more construction noise, more barricades, more ad hoc walkways for people to get around buildings, closed off spaces. It's not going to be pretty. There's going to have to be some accommodation on the part of the administration and students. But it is four decades in the coming. One UH regent said yesterday at a meeting, the backlog problem is sort of our ugly duckling. We really have got to take care of this.
Well, and looking at, well, what is the consequence of not doing it? I mean, clearly you got to do it. And the question is how that's going to happen. That's going to minimize impact to students and faculty. What does that look like?
Well, one thing they can do is they can shift courses around. They can have more evening classes, so that could help a lot. Construction not going to go on in the evening. Some faculty are probably going to have to double up on offices. I would imagine that's not going to go over terribly well. But I think everybody recognizes how long time this has been in coming. You know, I went to UH in the 90s, and the problems in repair and maintenance were so evident there. And here we are 20 years later, and we still got these very unfortunate problems at our premier campus.
So at this point, any bead on when we can expect to see some of this shift happening?
It's going to probably start happening soon, but first they've got to get some sign-offs. The UH and the administration, the lawmakers, the legislature, they've got a plan. They've given tentative, cautious approval to it. Revenue bonds financed by tuition dollars, but they're also going to have to go to the legislature this session and ask for more money. So there's still some things to work out, but they're hoping to have a plan, an overhaul in place by late March. And by the way, if you've been up to the campus, there is already construction going on, particularly in the campus center area. It's a bustling place.
Still going on.
Yes, exactly.
But the point being that it's got to get done. And at the point, seeing, well, how is this going to start possibly, what, summertime perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's when we can finally look at gearing this up. And imagine planning for a whole decade of this. And, of course, during that time, there will almost certainly be higher numbers of enrollment, tuition costs. Well, I don't want to say too much, but they'll probably go up at some point. But, you know, the Manoah campus alone, it's 100 years old. It is our flagship. There's 8 million square feet up there. There are bound to be problems. No wonder the backlog is in part over $400 million just for Manoah alone.
And we're going to wonder if any of the students are going to say, hey, we're consumers, and this isn't exactly the product we signed up to get.
Yeah, especially because the ones going to school now won't necessarily benefit it. They'll have graduated and moved on.
Especially if this is going to go over for 10 years. It's going to be interesting
exactly.
to see how this plays out. Thanks, Chad.
Sure.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square and talking about the effect of taxation on people who don't have a whole lot of money to give. Yeah.
Well, you might remember that a few months ago, the Hawaii Appleseed Center released a report on tax fairness for the state's moderate to low-income families, and it also had some suggested, you know, policy strategies accompanying that. Tonight, we're going to talk about those strategies and how they're going to be meeting up with a session that's going to start next week.
It's very tricky to create a tax structure that's equitable for every income level, isn't it? There's always somebody that's going to be getting it.
Well, I mean, tax is something we all pay, and the idea of fairness, what does fairness mean for people who have differing incomes? We've tried to address that in some fashion in the way the tax structure has been made to this point. But when you look at people who are in low income positions, and what happens is they're struggling, and some of those very real decisions they have to make that others at other income levels don't have to make, that's, you know, goes into how we have a growing homelessness population and other issues of people who are working but incredibly poor. And there are those organizations who are saying, hey, we got to look at this. So tonight we're going to do just that.
And of course, in Hawaii, the whole income standard is very different than it might be in another state for a number of reasons. Yeah.
And we'll talk about that tonight when Appleseed's executive director Victor Gemignani will be here, economist Chris Grandy, and the state coordinator on homelessness, Colin Kippen. So we hope you'll plan to join us tonight at 5.
Tonight at 5 on Town Square.
Sorry about that.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
And now we're going to pick up a conversation from several months back. You might remember that we talked about a case involving a young woman whose child had been put in the foster care system. She and her child were both minors at the time, and she didn't get appointed counsel. The case went on to the Hawaii Supreme Court with the support of several legal organizations who urged the court to consider not only the case of that underage mother, but the rights of all indigent parents, regardless of their ages. The court made its decision this week, and Nalani Fujimori Kaina, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society, joined us now by phone with an update. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, just to refresh everyone a little bit, I mean, I gave a little bit of that in the introduction, but any specific issues that you think that would be important for us to remember before we begin to talk about this case more fully?
I think the case itself is an interesting one because it was a minor parent who had been put into foster custody herself and had a minor child. And because she was appointed what they call a guardian ad litem to look out for her interests, they had not also appointed an attorney to represent her in the potential termination of rights to her child. So it was a slightly different situation than most that you see.
But in doing that and saying, okay, the guardian ad litem substitutes in some ways for having counsel, you know, real counsel, there apparently were some errors made and she lost her baby.
Right, exactly. Because the guardian ad litem is really looking at the interest of her as a minor and making the decisions for that minor in her best interest, but not representing her interest as a parent to her child. And so what the decision is really saying is that she deserved an attorney that was going to represent her with respect to her minor child.
And this obviously has ramifications for any parent who would be involved in a welfare proceeding where the child's ability to stay with the parent is threatened.
Oh, yes, and that's what's groundbreaking about this decision is that the court really did come out and say that any indigent parent who's facing foster custody and potential termination of their parental rights has a right to counsel and that the court should provide that it can no longer be done on a case-by-case analysis, which was happening in these situations where the judges were kind of making a determination from the bench based on the facts as to whether or not someone needed an attorney or not.
Right now, though, looking at how that's going to happen, how do you see this actually moving from a decision to action?
You know, I think the courts actually have been pretty good about providing counsel for parents that are not minors. The situation that I saw really in this case is that it's the dichotomy when you had the difficulty when you had a minor child that was already in the foster care system. And then had been, and that child also had another child, and that's when we were losing the appointment of counsel for those parents, for those minor parents.
And how many minor parents are we talking about?
You know, I can't tell you the number statewide, but it is a large number. I mean, I used to do this work on Maui as an attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii, and I had a number of cases where I had parents that I was appointed as guardian ad litem for, and we'd be requesting from the court that they also be appointed an attorney to represent them with the potential termination of rights to their minor children. So it happens, and I think part of the foster system, you know, there's just a number of mainly mothers in the system that end up having children while they're in the system.
Do you see any retroactive actions based on the outcome of this decision?
You know, I hope that, you know, if there are minor parents in the system that do not have counsel, that the court is going back and making sure that all of them are appointed counsel. You know, unfortunately, it may be too late in some of these situations, and that's really, you know, the sad part about all of this is that, you know, for minors who've had their rights terminated because they didn't have counsel in the past, it might be, you know, might be too late to be able to restore that relationship. And I think the difficult thing with child welfare cases is that, you know, you're looking both at the interest of the parent, but also the interest of the child and making sure that the child has a stable setting as well.
It sounds a little bit like that Judi Dench film, Philomena, that's out
yeah.
now, but not having art reflecting reality or which way around, if you're in it and it's your kid, it's a difficult situation. Are there children that you know now who are in the system who also have children? Are there other cases like this?
You know, there definitely will always be other cases like this. As to whether or not they have counsel, I think it's still, you know, because the cases are confidential, it's hard to tell exactly where all of those cases might be right now. So it's going to be really up to the court to take a look as those cases come before them and attorneys that are doing the work throughout the state, making sure that they request that counsel for those minor parents if they don't have one at this point.
The decision was a unanimous one. Were you at all sort of shaking your head why this hadn't come up before now?
You know, I think I was. I mean, I've been doing the work for a number of years previously, and, you know, I think there just wasn't maybe the right case to do it in, because a lot of times when the Supreme Court is reviewing cases, there's not enough of a situation where you had somebody who was doing well once they had counsel, so that they can say, look, there was a basis for, you know, appointing counsel, that counsel actually made a difference in this case. So this was really, I think, one of the perfect cases to be brought, and I think we really looked to Ben Lowenthal, who was the lead attorney for the mother in the appeal, for his taking a look at this case and moving forward with it.
Sometimes you just have to have the right case to be able to make the right point.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Nalani Fujimura Kaina is the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii. It's the oldest and largest statewide nonprofit organization providing free legal services to the poor. Legal Aid was one of the groups to call for the Hawaii Supreme Court's review of a case to give poor parents an appointed attorney in welfare proceedings. And more about the case is on HPR2.org. While we're picking up things from the past, let's take a look at our backyard quiz answer. This morning, we took a field trip to a local ukulele company, Kanalea, in Hawaiian. It means joyful sound, and according to fans, the ukuleles live up to their name's meaning in every imaginable way. Owned by Joseph and Kristen Sousa, the company manufactures both professional and more moderately priced models. Regardless of price, though, or model, ukuleles are all made with high-end woods and built with careful attention to detail. Kanalea's humidity-controlled facilities are located on the island of Oahu, and for today's quiz, we asked if you could tell us just where. Well, the answer is on Oahu's windward side in Kaneohe. It's now 8:44. That's today's quiz. And if you've got one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Eddie Kamai from the Sons of Hawaii. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
In addition to the ukulele, you might also have a taste for this next musical conversation. If you lean toward Broadway show tunes and partner dancing of the Fred and Ginger variety, your opportunities to live in that elegant world are all too rare. Its pleasures are timeless, and with the Maui Pops Orchestra's upcoming Broadway Pops Dancing and Romancing show, you now have your chance. Jim Durham is the conductor of the Maui Pops. He's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning to you.
You know, when Fred and Ginger, I mentioned Fred and Ginger, could have mentioned Gene Kelly, any of the other artists in the heyday of Gershwin songs and Broadway musicals and Broadway musicals on film, when that ceased to become the popular entertainment, something was lost that I'm not sure ever got recovered. Do you think?
Well, I think what stopped were the entertainers who were both experts at singing and dancing.
Yeah.
That's what's been lost. We still have singers, we still have dancers, but that combination is unusual. But this, this wonderful music does live on.
Yeah, it sure does. And you remind me of the time when a Gene Kelly was expected to be a double threat, or what they call a triple threat, right? Acting, singing, dancing.
Yes. And there were. I mean, one of the biggest surprises, I think, for most people were how well those who were most well known for dancing also were really excellent singers. Fred Astaire did not have a great singing voice, but he really could carry the song across and was quite successful at it.
He's a great example of what they call selling a song, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. And legendary for the hard work and their practice to make things perfect. So, I mean, we have a great selection of music on this program. Of course, Gershwin, we've got Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, Lowe, Frederick Lowe and Lerner, Cole Porter, and just, you know, on and on and on with wonderful songs. We'll be doing Singing in the Rain, which is, of course, made famous in the movie. Mm-hmm. And these entertainers that are coming are top-flight Broadway entertainers. Joan Hess is, you know, been on television repeatedly, Lincoln Center, Broadway, numerous awards all over. Kirby Ward entertained all over the world, many, many different nations, performed with a lot of the major symphonies. So these are top-notch Broadway stars coming. We're very, very excited about it.
And as Broadway performers, they're able to tour the world because there's an audience that's kind of hungry for that, yeah?
Well, yeah, because it's, you know, these are, although it's not considered classical music, these pieces are classics. They don't grow old because they're so well done. We were, you know, very fortunate to make a connection with John Such Management in New York City, and they put out these Bravo Broadway series with many, many performers, and this one Dancing and Romancing program that they have provided to us is one of their most popular programs. So I think it's going to be a terrific audience pleaser.
Some of the tunes, could you sort of give me a little bit of a preview of, say, some of the Jerome Kern, Gershwin selections?
I won't dance.
Oh.
You can't make me. I can't sing very well, but that's
don't
one of
ask
my favorites
yeah.
in the program. That's Jerome Kern. You can't take that away. Can't take that away from me by Gershwin.
Yeah.
Johnny One Note, Richard Rodgers. The song is You again, Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein. We're doing some overtures just with the orchestra, Girl Crazy. We're doing Chattanooga Choo Choo, which I think is going to be terrific fun, In the Mood.
Mm-hmm.
These are more like big band performances that we're doing with the full orchestra. All That Jazz, I Could Have Danced All Night, which is a special arrangement that's done that they dance to, which is a terrific arrangement. Salute to Cole Porter, Singing in the Rain, Begin the Beguine. It kind of runs the gamut of all that wonderful music.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that there's so many songwriters, and a lot of the songwriters moved around. You know, lyricists worked for more than one tunesmith. You know, Oscar Hammerstein wrote for a number of songwriters, as did Ira Gershwin. And yet there, you can put these songs together, and they're very, by the different writings teams, and they're very compatible with one another.
Yes, and there was clearly a style of music back then. You find a lot of the rhythmic motifs are the same from piece to piece, but they weave them around to make them just a little bit different. But it's a very jazzy type of style, very upbeat and very, very active. And of course, that's you know, expressed through the dance as well as through the words of the songs.
You know, traditionally, Jim, the rhythms that are referred to as jazzy, that kind of what they call the dotted eighth feel of a swing rhythm, that can be difficult to translate to an orchestra, can't it? Or can it?
Well, yes, it is. It's very, very difficult music to play. It has to be extremely precise, and when you're accompanying, you know, high-quality singers and dancers, and we get literally one rehearsal with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a difficult program for us. And when they're performing, one thing the orchestra has to be careful to do is make sure we get out of their way. You know, we don't want to put them in a position where they're not comfortable. So it is a challenging program.
Sure. And, of course, with every singer, you're kind of the ultimate guide to, say, just tempo and the timing of a piece has to be the vocals. So for you as the conductor, you've kind of have to watch the singers like a hawk, don't you?
I definitely do. However, with these this level of performer where they have repeated this program numerous times with numerous different conductors and orchestras, they're pretty well versed in how what they do to help keep us stay together.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways it's difficult, and in some ways they make it easy.
And now I would think that for your orchestra members it could be extremely educational as well, yeah?
Well, on a concert like this, you kind of don't have time to be educational.
Uh-huh.
This is a busy program for the players.
Sure.
They are in the music all the way through the concert. I mean, we got, I think there's 19 songs on this concert. It is a, it's quite a mouthful of music for our orchestra.
So when you have that one rehearsal with the performers, you probably can't go through all 19 songs in real time. What are the kind of things that?
We definitely do.
You do?
We absolutely go right straight through everything in real time.
And
we have to, yeah.
And then stop at each one and maybe address any little shaky points? Or how do you make adjustments?
Usually the shaky points come between me and the soloist. Like, I want a little more time here. I want to slow down a little bit more. I want to go a little bit faster,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing. We literally won't have time to do any serious rehearsal. The orchestra has to be prepared before the soloists get here.
So you're really, in rehearsal, you're obviously not learning the songs in that rehearsal.
Not at the dress rehearsal, no.
No,
the
that would be.
Dress rehearsal, we're just, we are adding the artist to what we've already, what we've already worked on in our previous rehearsals.
Really just sort of nuances, I would think, of timing, intros and outros, that kind of thing, yeah?
Some of it has to do with getting the feel for how the soloist works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my challenge, is to, do the kind of Vulcan mind meld musically with them so that I understand and feel what they're doing. And that usually with one time through that, at the dress rehearsal, then we're comfortable.
Well, a Vulcan mind meld is a pretty good description of what it is, because you can't spend a lot of time making decisions on stage once you're up there performing, can you?
No. Well, a long time back in the day when I played in the orchestra, and people would ask, how do you follow the conductor? And the answer is by osmosis. I mean, you're not able to describe it. It is just something that you have through instinct. And that's what you do with this with these performers, and they will be very clear in their body language and their expression and how they speed up and slow down, so that we stay together.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us, Jim, and it sounds like a great show. I wish you all kinds of luck with it.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
You bet. Jim Durham is the conductor of the Maui Pops Orchestra, which is presenting Broadway Pops Dancing and Romancing January 19th at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. And you can find out more on our HPR2 website.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I see when we're out together, dancing cheek to cheek. Yes.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering private banking, trust administration, and financial management services to help individuals and families reach their financial goals. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
Roz Cohen returns to the Atherton January 11th with Bossa, Broadway, Borscht, and All That Jazz. Music veterans Josh Kay, Ernie Preventure, Bill Noble, and Jerome James join Roz for an evening of timeless music and shtick. Saturday, January 11th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at 955-8821. During business hours or online at hprtickets.org.
Beth Ann, you started off the show talking about the ongoing GMO discussion that's so much alive in Hawaii and was referred to in a lengthy New York Times piece over the weekend. And the problems with the discussion have to do with the confluence of science and emotion, yeah?
Well, that's where it's been for a long time, which is why you keep hearing this resounding refrain, can we get some independent studies, and who will be able to do that? And knowing that that's going to take time, because we're talking about longevity here. Mm-hmm. It's nothing that's going to happen soon. So I guess you're in luck, because this whole thing is going to be continuing, Chris.
I feel so lucky.
Well, that's going to do it for us for today on the Friday Agenda. Bookstores may be quickly vanishing from commercial scenes, but in college, they're a necessity. Tomorrow, we're going to look at UH's new textbook buying tools.
And an adventurous new theater project on Kauai, exploring the exciting new medium of radio.
Meanwhile, you can talk back to us by phone, Facebook, Twitter, or email.
And
I was going to say, all of our contact information is right there on hpr2.org.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, all of that is there, too, in the archive on the HPR2 website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and we'll meet you right back here tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.